Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. California is starting to reopen, albeit slowly but surely. Now that there are rules for restaurants and retail stores, what about for the rest of us? All the huggers, fist bumpers, and social butterflies who've had enough of being cooped up. Plus, the pandemic has pushed many of LA's independent restaurants over the edge. We'll hear from three that are fighting to stay alive. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm E. Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. Quarantine fatigue is real. I can really hear your heads nodding all across Southern California. Now, by now, a lot of us can attest to the psychological toll physical distancing has caused. Depression, anxiety, irritability. You probably have your own list. Or maybe you don't. I don't care. You hear that? I'm irritable. That is why this chapter in our global pandemic is especially hard. As a whole, the state is nowhere near ready to return to business as usual, yet we are moving toward that with restaurants offering dine-in service, salons opening doors, and there's even talk of pro sports resuming in some sort of capacity. But still, the big question is, how are we going to do this? What are the rules, not just for restaurants and retail businesses, but for the rest of us? Rules for you and me. Well, that is where we're going to start today. One epidemiologist argues that the choice between staying home indefinitely and returning to business as usual now is a false one, and that proceeding somewhere in the middle without a definitive roadmap could have some unintended consequences. Julia Marcus is an epidemiologist and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. She shared her take in The Atlantic. Julia, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Quarantine fatigue is real. That's the title of your piece. I mentioned a few symptoms of it, but digging a little deeper, what is quarantine fatigue and how are you seeing it come out?
Well, I mean, I think we're all, as you said, feeling it at this point. But we are seeing quarantine fatigue also from a research perspective. We're seeing increased medication use for anxiety. And I fear that we're going to see increases in depression and consequences of those real.
Hey, Julia, if you could, can you move a little closer to the receiver? That's kind of our new reality here in radio. We got to make sure that the connection is as strong as possible.
Sure. Is this any better?
Yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect. So keep going on how do you see quarantine fatigue coming out?
I think we're seeing it both from a research perspective, the mental health impacts and of isolation. And then also just what we're all feeling on an everyday basis, which is the need for human contact and trying to figure out now that places are starting to think about reopening and it's clear that we're going to have to be doing this for the long term, how we're going to be able to live our lives in a sustainable way with enough human contact to keep us going, but while minimizing the risk of coronavirus transmission.
Now, Julia, in your piece, you compare the shelter-at-home orders for this virus to abstinence-only messaging at the height of the HIV crisis. Both, you say, just don't work. How so?
Well, the abstinence-only messaging comparison here, I was really thinking about the stay-home message that we, to be clear, really needed these last couple months. We needed to have this big shift in human behavior to ensure that our healthcare system wasn't overwhelmed and to try to flatten the curve. And we needed that and it was effective. But now we're realizing that this unfortunately is gonna be a situation we're gonna have to sustain to some extent for months, if not years. And having this approach that is just, where the only message is stay home, save lives, it's just not gonna work in the long term because people need to find ways to interact. And the problem with this abstinence-only message, and any abstinence-only message, is that it doesn't give information about how to keep your risk low. It just gives you information about the zero-risk option, which is staying home or abstinence. But actually, there are ways that we can interact with people that are fairly low-risk, and people are already choosing to do that on an everyday basis. Many people are not staying home all the time, and so we need to give them tools to reduce their risk in various situations.
And it sounds, Julia, that people will hear the messaging, but start to do stuff kind of on the down low a little bit.
Right. So that's the other risk of abstinence-only messaging is that we may inadvertently stigmatize anything that's not 100% risk reduction. And we're definitely seeing a lot of shaming going on for anybody who's on social media. We all know that that's happening, been happening for the last couple months. And we also see it happening in person, in parks or, you know, beaches, wherever people are out and visible. There's shaming going on. And what we don't want is for people to take that, they're socializing indoors where it's actually higher risk than if it's outdoors. Or you can imagine a situation where contact tracers are trying to get in touch with people who may have been exposed and people are afraid to say that they attended an event. And that's the last thing we want.
And Julia, I'll admit, I've shaken my fist from afar, looking at pictures of the beach, people just all in a big group or doing stuff, as you mentioned, that doesn't make a lot of safe health-wise. So to these unintended consequences you highlight, how do people tend to think when it looks like they only have two options, where it's black or white dealing with this, stay home or go out? So what do people think?
Well, I worry that what we will see is that people cannot stay home, just in the way that people can't, you know, in the early 80s, people weren't going to be able to abstain from sex for years on end, when we had that message at the height of the HIV epidemic. And without messaging that gives people a sense of how to reduce their risk and, you know, what lower risk situations are, people may just give up on all of it and go back to business as usual, which is really not something we should be doing right now, because we may see a huge surge in cases if we do that. So it's important that we figure out how we can live our lives in a sustainable way while keeping risk as low as possible. And the messaging needs to adapt to that new reality.
Talking to Julia Marcus, an epidemiologist and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. So part of moving away from this abstinence-only approach really means public health officials educating people about lower-risk behaviors that are more sustainable in the long term. And it just seems like part of the problem here that people don't generally have a good idea of the risk that comes with each activity. So, Julia, based on your training, are there some rules of thumb that public health officials might use?
Yeah, I mean, when we're thinking about developing really nuanced public health guidelines that would be useful right now, I think we should be thinking from a harm reduction perspective. And when we approach something from that perspective, we think about a whole continuum of risk rather than just giving people information about the safest option. So we might tell people that staying home is still the safest possible thing you can do. But here are other things that you can do that are low risk, like going outdoors. And when you're outdoors, maintain physical distancing, wear a mask, try to, you know, make sure your interactions are fairly brief. There are all these things that can allow us to go, you know, engage in recreational activities while keeping our risk low. And we may want to provide also harm reduction tips for the highest risk end of the spectrum. So if you're going to go ahead and have that party right now, if you're just set on it, even though you know that it's high risk, here are things you can do to reduce your risk in that situation. Try to have the party outdoors. You know, try to have fewer guests. Like we need to give people tools to reduce harm across the board.
Don't invite grandma and grandpa either, right? If you're going to have it just makes sense. Do some things that make a little bit of sense as well. Now, Julia, your last suggestion goes along with the idea of shaming. You say that they should be provided with tools on how to minimize transmission risk. Like what? What would be one of those tools?
Well, you know, some of the ones I mentioned are key, like physical distancing and trying to be outdoors as much as possible. I think that's really going to be key, especially over these next few months as the weather is pretty nice all, you know, across the country. This is a time when we should be thinking about not only on an individual level taking our socializing outside, but for businesses and for cities to be thinking about how, from a structural perspective, we can move indoor services outdoors, open up more streets for people to recreate, but also for, you know, haircuts to be outside. And it started thinking really creatively about ways that we can take these, what we feel to be essential parts of our lives and make them as low risk as possible.
You mentioned haircuts, Julia. A little later in the show, we're going to hear from one of our reporters who found some underground haircuts happening all over Southern California. I mean, my hair is longer than it's been in a long time, Julia, and I haven't done that yet. So big picture, Julia, I've said the words public health officials a lot, but on a national level, these kinds of guidelines have been far and few. Whose job is it to educate people in ways to stay happy and healthy?
I think ideally we would see that guidance coming at a national level where it's a unified message, as opposed to, you know, different health departments coming up with different messages for different communities. But in the absence of that, I think really it is going to be up to state and local health departments to develop this kind of guidance and make sure that they're communicating really clearly about the nuances of risk to their residents.
Julia Marcus is an epidemiologist and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Julia, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Earlier, I mentioned pro sports coming back. Governor Newsom surprised us all this week by saying sporting events could start up again that first week or so of June without spectators and with modifications and very prescriptive conditions. Though it seems unlikely that balls will be bouncing on June 1st, which is 2 weeks from yesterday, the door is opening. And it got us thinking about the sports legalities of a return to the hardwood, diamond, or gridiron. Kenneth Shropshire is Distinguished Professor of Global Sport at Arizona State University and was Director of the Wharton Sports Business Initiative. Kenneth, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
All right, now let's start with the NBA. 17 teams, including the Lakers and Clippers, have opened facilities primarily for players rehabbing injuries or individually working out. They still can't have practice as a team. And the word is the league will decide what it plans to do sometime between June 1st and the 15th. Kenneth, how much will this be a de facto test case for other leagues to learn from?
Huge. I think every move that we see by every league around the world actually is serving as guidance to the other leagues. So all these are indicators in terms of how safe and what steps to take.
So they really are kind of looking at each other in terms of the legalities and liability to see, okay, what works, what doesn't work, what maybe we can change if we haven't opened up yet.
That's right. I mean, at its core, I mean, if you think as a leader in kind of worst case, you're thinking, what's the liability I could suffer if something goes wrong? So here, as players, you come back into a situation, you have all the information, and have the leagues done everything that they know they could do to make things safer.
Now, considering that the coronavirus pandemic shut the NBA down midseason, do NBA players have any bargaining power regarding the conditions in which they'd come back to?
I think they have a lot of bargaining power. And I think the balance that we're going to see is how determined are they to come back. I mean, there's so many things in sport now that have this kind of balance. You know, if you step back and you think about kids playing football, knowing that CTE exists, and our parents thinking that there's a future career for these kids or scholarships. With the coronavirus, it's not too different. I mean, the idea that as a player, you come back knowing there's some risk. Are you willing to take that risk to get your paycheck, to play the game you love, all those sorts of things?
Now, Kenneth, all that brings us to Major League Baseball as the league and the Players Union are in their second week of discussions about a plan to begin a short season in July. Now, parts of the plan include cooperation from as many as 27 U.S. cities and Toronto, and also to have as many as 200,000 tests available for what they call frequent testing, not daily testing, but frequent testing. First off, Kenneth, how is this situation different and perhaps trickier than the one that the NBA is in?
Who's the evaluator of which sport is safest in this setting? It does seem like it's easier to keep distance in baseball than in basketball. So I have always thought of baseball being the sport that if it can be figured out, they might be the ones that can put enough rules in place where there's at least a higher degree of safety for the players. Again, the other leagues will watch and see what they can take. But think about it. In baseball, you can say, no sliding in a second or something like that. But basketball and football is a lot tougher. That contact that takes place there is a lot different from what you see in baseball and in hockey as well.
Talking to Kenneth Shropshire, Distinguished Professor of Global Sport at Arizona State University, and we're talking about sports coming back from a legal perspective. Kenneth, if you were an attorney with the Major League Baseball Players Union, what would be some of your key concerns for them?
If you're telling me my men can come back, what protections are you putting in place? What are you willing to do in terms of compensation if things do go bad? So even to the ultimate, I mean, somebody's got to ask the question, What if death does occur? What are we going to do? And how rapidly can we shut things down? But also, you know, compensation to families and the like if we go forward. And certainly from the league standpoint, my counterpart would be saying, can we shift the liability over to the players? Can we get a waiver from the players?
Wow.
If the ultimate death occurs, here's the number that will be distributed. So it can be some really complex conversation.
I know that MLB and the players union are not just discussing safety, but also how to share revenue and decide on salaries for a short season. Could this become a situation, Kenneth, where players might trade safety for cash?
I hope not. But what's the question? Does everybody have a number? I don't know. The better off you are, the more likely you are to push for the ultimate in safety. You know, how many players are going to say, I'm not coming back until there's a proven vaccination that's been distributed widely? So how short of that are you willing to head back in? And how much can money influence you to come back earlier than you would if given the choice?
Now, at the moment, the NFL does have one thing that the NBA and Major League Baseball do not, and that's time. What kinds of things could the NFL and its players have in mind as it watches how this plays out for their counterparts?
I heard today they're looking at different, new types of face masks that can serve to further protect the players from infection from other players on the field of play. This is a great moment for innovation. Somebody was talking about antimicrobial basketball that he cleans itself, right? If you could invent that, you'd be a big payday for you. There will be some innovation that will take place. And I think the NFL is counting on a lot of that taking place before they have the first kickoff.
So on that note, Kenneth, you mentioned this could be a big moment for sports to reset, to rethink how things can be done differently. So what should be done differently going forward, say in 2021, assuming that we're in a much better place health-wise as a country?
I mainly think about the high school and college level. I think about how we have let that get so out of hand in terms of the time that's devoted by these young men and women who are in school. Maybe there shouldn't be as many games as there are that they have to play. Maybe there should be shortened seasons. Maybe they should have the opportunity to focus on education more. And what difference would that make? If we restart and everybody's doing the same thing, that could very well be a good thing.
Kenneth Shropshire is Distinguished Professor of Global Sport at Arizona State University and was Director of the Wharton Sports Business Initiative. Kenneth, as always, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So there we heard about sports coming back, but what about places to eat? Independent restaurants such as Lassa, Joy on York, and Tavern, they make up a vital part of LA's cultural fabric. They provide an alternative to big chain eateries that are always the same anywhere you go in the U.S. Now, while independent restaurants have always had very narrow margins, the pandemic has pushed many of LA's restaurants that are just like that to the brink of extinction. Coming up, we're going to hear how those three are fighting to stay alive, all while also reinventing themselves as they go along. That's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Da-da, da-da. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. Last week, the state released industry guidance for how restaurants could return to some sort of dine-in service. Key prevention practices include physical distancing to the maximum extent possible, meaning fewer seats, the mandatory use of face coverings by employees and customers and clients, frequent hand washing and regular cleaning and disinfection, among many others. But as California eases its stay-at-home order, what does the future of restaurants in Los Angeles look like? To discuss, we've gathered together voices from a few of LA's most beloved eateries. Joining us now is Chef Suzanne Goen, whose restaurants include AOC, Tavern, and The Larder. Welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
Also with us, Chase Valencia, general manager and co-owner of LASA. Chase, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And one more, Chef Vivian Koo, restaurateur behind Joy in Highland Park and Pine and Crane in Silver Lake. Vivian, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. First off, I want to ask each of you what your experience has been like during this closure, which began on March 16th. Vivian, let's start with you. Joy has actually been 100% closed since the order. How have you been managing it, and what are your plans? What kind of plans do you have in place?
Back in mid-March, it felt like every single day we were implementing something new, whether it was removing all the condiments first and then limiting the number of guests in the dining room at a time. Pretty quickly, we turned to takeout and delivery only a few hours before the mandate, actually. And then hearing about, you know, the PPP loan and the coronavirus relief bill, we just thought it would be best to send everyone home, mostly for, you know, the well-being of the staff. And now that we're coming up on 2 months, we realize that we probably have to open back up and do some sort of limited takeout or delivery to keep the businesses afloat.
Chase Valencia, what about you? Since the order came down, LASA has taken to curating quarantine meal kits instead of just a regular takeout. Why'd you opt for this method, and how's that been going?
We thought about how can we still engage and interact with our guests in a fun way besides hot food. And we felt like with these meal kits, it's like we part the kitchen partially cooks and prepares the kits. The guests are able to take them home with easy instructions to prepare. Essentially, they're just rewarming everything. Mm-hmm. And we include like a playlist, and the instructions are actually printed on our old menu papers. So it made us feel as if we're still able to connect in some capacity. And so far, it's been good.
Now, Suzanne Goen, we actually got a hold of you pretty soon after the stay-at-home order came down. You permanently shuttered your longtime restaurant, Luke, before you had planned to, and closed the door to your other eateries. So, Suzanne, how have things been going since? How have you been able to adapt?
So we actually just reopened 2 weeks ago for takeout and delivery. We did get a PPP loan, and we feel like we're sort of using this as a time to, you know, we were able to bring our employees back. And it's a way for us to really experiment with the takeout and delivery and see, you know, how much revenue we can bring in, what the, you know, how much people will order, how much, and then also how much staff do we really need to run it? Because the revenue is definitely going to be, you know, a fraction of what we were bringing in before. So we're kind of using this as a time to figure out what it really takes to do it and what the demand is. And then I think when our 8 weeks of PPP are up, we're going to have to lay some people off again because we definitely don't need our whole staff. So that's kind of the conundrum is how many people can we keep on to execute this new program? So I think the thing about the PPP is it's an 8 week Band-Aid to an 18 month problem. I think the PPP it's a great tool. It's kind of like a bridge to the next step. And it's funny because they just made a lot of changes to the PPP improvements. So I think people who are getting it now actually have, it'll be much more useful. We got it the first round when there was that 8 week rule. Mm. And I think they just changed it to 24, which is much more helpful because you can spread out using that time. We've sort of found the best way to use it in our situation, but it is definitely not going to be what saves us.
No, Suzanne, I actually just wanted to say thanks just because, like, we all understand that it's all individual, each restaurant, and how as operators, what are we going to do to utilize it? And we're all in our own respective neighborhoods, clientele, and expectations and wants from our own respective restaurants. So to fulfill that, all staffed up through a to-go scenario sounds very challenging for all of us. So I agree 100% that it's not the answer. It is the Band-Aid. And it's just really hard when we first found out that once you get the PPP loan, the clock is ticking. And that's a scary thing because it's like, do I utilize it or not? And so we're all It's all brand new to us.
Chase and Suzanne, I want to ask Vivian, I want to bring her in on this. Have you explored the PPP loan?
Yes, and we actually recently got funded, and there's like a lot of things that are unanswered. I feel like they're asking small business owners to do like take a loan and then do like 10 things that's constantly shifting when, you know, I wish we kind of did it like a lot of the European countries where it's like you fund a portion of payroll. It doesn't have to be 100%, but it's a lot more straightforward. It's a lot less arbitrary in terms of like who gets it. You know, I feel for people who don't get it, who didn't get it, who don't might not have like the energy or the resources to go through that entire process. I just wish this was all, you know, done differently, but you know, it's a little bit too late now.
So one universal struggle for all small businesses are feeling right now is the economic blowback of this pandemic. As heads of your restaurants, how do you strike that balance between safety, keeping things in operation, then actually making a profit? Suzanne, let's start with you on that.
Well, for safety-wise, that was why we just closed right away, because it was so many unknowns. And I didn't feel safe bringing my staff to work just because I didn't know. And the public health issue. So we just decided, okay, we shut it down. But it was crazy within 3 days. One day I was like, oh my gosh, we have to lay off our part-time employees. And then 12 hours later, I was like, we have to lay off our hourly employees. And next thing I knew, I was laying off everybody. You know, all of our managers, people who worked for me for 20 years. And it was too big for us to handle. I mean, we couldn't, you know, in the past, if we have an employee has an issue, we are like a family. I know it's a cliche, but it's true. And we jump in and help that person, but this was just too much. And so that's kind of in that moment that we sort of chose the public health and the health and safety of everyone over anything else. We just had to shut it down. But now I feel like we understand it better. We, you know, we're all getting tested. We have the safety and cleaning protocols in place. And this is the moment where we kind of try to balance, like you said, I don't feel like we're putting anybody's health at risk. It's more now trying to figure out how to make a profit or break even so that we can employ our staff.
Yeah. And Chase, for you and your brother, Chad, I mean, I remember you guys doing pop-ups. I remember going to some of your pop-ups and you're trying to find a brick and mortar to get your restaurant idea and concept going and have some footing. And now you get some footing and all of a sudden this happened. So how are you, same question, balancing that safety operation and making a profit if possible?
Yeah, like Suzanne mentioned, and it is not cliche, restaurants end up becoming more of your family. You end up working with them so close and so intimately, side by side, and especially for us being such a small restaurant, family-owned business, their welfare and the well-being is so important. And it's about keeping that in mind until things open up in terms of guidelines, if we can increase more people inside the restaurant. And it's just all of us, I would say all restaurants, we're working in limitations. And try to maximize to, yes, agree, like to just break even or get by, and hopefully we pull through. So for us, we want to evolve. What else can we do besides these meal kits? I know a lot more restaurants are starting to come back online, like Vivian, and because we're getting to that point where we need to show up and we need to start paying our rent, we need to start having a business again.
Vivian, for you, considering that you said you're going to have to open up at some point or as quickly as possible, now that you've seen everything that's been going on, that same question for you in terms of balancing safety, operation, and making a profit, what kind of plan have you thought about?
We're running skeleton crews, trying to build a menu where we can have the minimum amount of staff working at a given time. But for us, you know, we feel like, you know, we've installed plexiglass. I actually just installed these like really crazy plexiglass exteriors at Pine and Crane. And then I was like, oh, but I want airflow. So it's like, how do you get fresh air airflow, but then also want to block out the germs? And I'm like constantly going back and forth on these things. But we're definitely trying to make sure that we're doing it as responsibly as possible. I created like a safety officer position on the team. So they're like, their job is just like remind people like when half an hour is up and like everyone should like wash their hands and take everyone's temperatures and whatnot.
We're talking to Chef Suzanne Goen, Elasa co-owner Chase Valencia, and chef and restaurateur Vivian Koo. All of your restaurants are unique, and the one thing that's been really clear through all this is that there is not a one-size-fits-all solution to this situation. Now, as the state slowly moves into easing restrictions, I'm curious how you're envisioning reopening. We just heard from Vivian on how she's envisioning it. Suzanne, what does that look like for your restaurants?
Oh, we have those plexiglass people must be very busy right now. We have
they're everywhere, every store possible. Yeah, right.
And we've definitely been, you know, exploring the, you know, measuring out the 6 feet to the left, you know, 6 feet from back of one chair, 6 feet another. Try to lay out what our new floor plan is. Do the plexiglass thing. In a way, I feel like all the physical limitations are difficult and the new rules, but we're very adaptive. I think all of us. I think that's a restaurant person thing. Is we can do all the pivoting and we can finagle and figure stuff out. To me, the most difficult thing, like long term, like how are we going to stabilize our industry? Because, you know, we're 11 million jobs in the country, and there's another 10 million jobs that rely on our industry. And, you know, I'm a member of this group called the Independent Restaurant Coalition. And our mission now is to create a stabilization fund for restaurants, to have the government establish something, because we truly believe that to stabilize us is to stabilize the economy. So, yes, we're spending a lot of time figuring out, you know, new models and how many servers we need and all that. But at the end of the day, I think our industry needs intervention and we need something. I mean, if you think about the airline industry, we employ 15 times more people than the airline industry. So you think about the farmers and the linen companies and the florists and the fishermen and liquor companies and dairy farmers, everything, you know, that depends on our business and if our industry goes down, we're taking all that down with us. So not to mention the soul of the community, you know, the community part and what we bring, you know, creatively and as part of the culture of a place.
One last thing for all three of you, because one of the things that makes LA really a one-of-a-kind kind of place is the unique and colorful patchwork of independent restaurants that make up its food scene. It's the social fabric of LA, its restaurants. That's the mosaic, the cultural mosaic that Jonathan Gold always used to rave about. This pandemic is threatening that. So what will be lost if the majority of these restaurants do not make it? Chase Valencia, let's start with you.
These food options will be just more homogenized, and that diversity, that point of view that these chefs, restaurants, and these concepts that we're providing, it brings a level of excitement and uniqueness to our city, and it really celebrates who we are as Angelenos. And to take that away, and this pandemic potentially threatening that, it's a scary thing. Vivian, Suzanne, everyone that I've spoken to, a lot of us restaurateurs have been very close, chatting, communicating, checking in on each other, because it's a really tough battle that we're all facing. And we all want to let everyone, each other, know that we're all here for each other, to build a camaraderie, that we are scrappy and we're going to pull through and we're going to keep fighting. You know, we work so hard to have these restaurants. We all know how razor thin the margins are. And we just want to keep going and persevering. And we just got to get creative and push.
Vivian Koo, what about you? What will be lost if some of these restaurants don't make it back?
You know, I've been trying to stay hopeful, you know, learning to just thrive in this new environment as much as possible. You know, we have to come back because, you know, we realize this is not just something that will actually even be over in another month. I see this impacting us for several months out.
Suzanne Gowen, what about you? You got the last word on this. What's going to be lost if a lot of these independent restaurants can't make it back?
I feel like if we lose the small independent restaurants that make up LA, we're going to lose a lot of our heart and soul and a lot of what makes Los Angeles the great city that it is. It's not just a sea of giant chain restaurants. I mean, our restaurants really represent who we are as a city. And for that to be gone is, like I said before, it's heartbreaking. We'll lose part of our soul.
That's Chef Suzanne Gowen, Lassa co-owner Chase Valencia, and chef and restaurateur Vivian Koo. Thank you, all three of you. And I think the entire city, I can speak for everyone, we're all rooting for you to come back stronger than before.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, there was a time when I used to have a thriving civilization of hair on top of my head. It was long and glorious, just like the Incan Empire, but over time it went to ruins, just like Machu Picchu. Now, to compensate, I get very short fades. It minimizes the thinning on top if it's short all around, but if you can't get a fade regularly, it can look exactly like I look right now, super sloppy. Even so, I have not turned to underground barbershops, but a lot of people have. That story's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
buttons near the station. Black roof country, no gold pavements, tired starlings. Silver horses ran down moonbeams in your dark.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. We've been talking about reopening throughout the show today, and as you've likely heard, Governor Gavin Newsom announced Monday that it could be legal to get a haircut again in a salon in California within a few weeks. Of course, people have been getting haircuts secretly since the stay-at-home order began, as KPCC's Emily Guerin reports.
In late April, I saw two freshly shaven men walk out of a barbershop in Venice that was supposed to be closed. Then, a week later, my hairstylist emailed and said he was doing home visits. So I started wondering about clandestine haircutting. How risky is it? Who's doing it? And why? I searched Craigslist, where I found a handful of stylists in LA offering illicit cuts, including Carmel, who asked me not to use her last name because she knows what she's doing is not allowed right now.
I wasn't expecting a high volume at all. And when my phone had over 100 texts in one day, I was like, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? There's a lot of people out there that needs haircuts.
Carmel used to work in a salon, but she got furloughed in March. Her manager incorrectly informed her that she was not eligible for unemployment. She tried applying for jobs at grocery stores, but she got nowhere. So with no money coming in, she started cutting hair out of her living room in Compton. She wears a mask, disinfects everything between clients, and she tells them,
make sure you come with clean hair, clean clothes. You will be asked to sanitize your hand before you come into the home and after you leave.
A spokesperson for the California Board of Barbering and Cosmetology said they were sympathetic to the plight of people like Carmel, but they reiterated, home haircuts are not allowed, and the people who do it could be penalized. But Carmel says she's doing nothing wrong.
Before you judge, put yourself in my situation first. My hands are tied.
But the fear of disciplinary action is pretty anxiety-provoking for one LA area salon owner I spoke with, who's been doing home visits.
It's like I need a nap. I did one person and I'm like exhausted when my average day was 12 people.
She also asked me not to use her name. People who get clandestine haircuts are anxious too, but about something else.
The shaming. I've been shamed by strangers and friends for, you know, posting stuff online where I'm not just sitting at home.
This is Whitney, an LA resident who asked me not to use her name because her longtime stylist cut and dyed her hair on her back deck recently. She rinsed the dye out in the kitchen sink. Whitney says she did it because she's getting divorced and she just needed a little self-care.
I was like, you know what? I need this. I need to feel good. I need to have a haircut. I need to do something that feels normal.
Public officials who look too groomed on camera also risk being shamed. Recently, Newport Beach salon owner Melissa Sprout accused the Orange County Board of Supervisors of getting haircuts on the sly while forcing salons to stay closed.
As a hairstylist, I can see that many of you have had services done in the last 6 weeks. If politicians are using our services illegally, surely they find us essential.
Supervisor Donald Wagner shot back.
I have not had my hair cut since well before this started, and if you want to get a close-up look, talk to me afterwards.
Getting your haircut at home may actually be safer than going to a salon, says Seth Gordon Benzel, a researcher at MIT who recently wrote a paper about the risks of reopening various businesses.
What's really dangerous is people sitting around in crowded, small barbershops.
But he says every interaction with a new person increases your risk of transmitting the coronavirus. So before you decide to get a home haircut, ask yourself, is it really worth it?
Do I really want to be spending my limited sort of social contact budget on this? Or is there something more important that I want to spend my very few human interactions that I'm allowing myself on?
You could always pay a barber to guide you via FaceTime while you cut your own hair. Because, thanks to the coronavirus, that's a real thing. I'm Emily Guerin.
All right, moving on. Starting this week, undocumented families in California can apply for financial support to help them through the pandemic. Governor Newsom announced the state-funded program last month, and yesterday there were so many calls from people in need, the system crashed. But Yasmin Franco was finally able to get through and help her family apply for the relief program.
The fund that the governor created to help undocumented families is something that is extremely helpful, and it's something that provides hope to families like mine. We're all just trying to get a little bit of aid.
Franco is a DACA recipient in Southern California, and we had her on the show last month. She received a stimulus check in March, but her parents hadn't been able to qualify for any financial aid from the government after they were laid off from their jobs. That is, until now. Newsom said about 150,000 people will receive a one-time check of $500 from the relief fund. Each household will receive up to $1,000. The funds will be distributed through 12 nonprofit organizations, including the National Day Laborer Organizing Network in Los Angeles. Pablo Alvarado is the co-director, and he's working to connect undocumented people with these organizations.
Undocumented families are some of the most vulnerable members of our society. And if we want to be well, we have to make sure that those who have the least are protected, are taken care of. Because if we protect the most vulnerable members of our society, we're going to protect everyone.
Applications will be accepted until June 30th or until funds run out. All right, now to your stories. KPCC and LAist are documenting life in the new normal with diary entries from everyday Angelenos. Julie Bien, who teaches journalism at Cal State Northridge, has been thinking what many of us have been thinking. Is it okay to feel bad if you haven't been too badly affected by the pandemic?
It's been a rough few years for myself as well. I lost my mom just over 2 years ago last week. I lost my grandmother right before that. I had a number of health scares and surgeries and various other things. It's definitely been interesting to think about mourning right now. I felt sort of uncomfortable mourning in a way I would have maybe more publicly mourned prior because I know so many people are going through so many different types of grief right now. It was interesting to sort of consider my grief in sort of the scope of everyone else's collective grief. You make choices like that where I'm like, well, do I want to add to this? Will that make me feel better? Will that make someone else feel worse? It's an interesting way to think about the world.
See more of Julie's diary entry and submit your own at laist.com. That's LAIST.com. All right, reopening is a thing right now in California, and it's also a big theme of the show today. We've heard about how it could look for pro sports, independent restaurants and barbershops, also hair salons as well. And since beaches and hiking trails have already been open, what's next? Anything else you'd like to go to? How about theme parks? Theme parks like Disneyland, Magic Mountain, Knott's Berry Farm, all that. The plans for those are coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and on the KPCC app. I'm Ian Martinez. It can be really hard to maintain 6 feet of distance when it's a small world, after all. But theme parks such as Disneyland are starting to slowly roll out ideas on how they can reopen with safety in mind. Now, that first step came last week when Disney announced the procedure for guests entering Florida's Disney Springs. That area is similar to downtown Disney here in Anaheim. So to help us understand how reopened theme parks might look and when people would want to go to them, we have with us Robert Niles, founder and editor of the site Theme Park Insider. Robert, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. All right. Can you walk us through what will be happening in Disney Springs from a visitor's point of view? What will be new?
Yeah, basically, Florida is allowing restaurant dining in and retail to open up. So Disney's decided to take the first step towards reopening the Walt Disney World Resort by basically doing a little beta test, dress rehearsal, allowing people into their Disney Springs area. Now, everyone who comes in has to have a face covering. You've got to be wearing a mask. You get a temperature check before you can come into the area. And then they're trying to promote social distancing by keeping people 6 feet apart at all times, spacing out some of the tables in the restaurants, going to more and more contactless payments. They've got that magic band system, remember, there that you can with. And also trying to get people to use their cell phones. So they're really trying to avoid cash and anything that puts people in direct physical contact with one another. So, you know, some basic principles in trying to promote hygiene and safety within the resort.
But Robert, why start with an area, with an open area like that instead of one of the theme parks?
Well, first of all, because, you know, it's free to get in, so the stakes are relatively low. People come in and they feel uncomfortable by the whole experience. It's not like they spend $100 a day to be there, and they're probably not going to complain that much. Everyone understands that this is basically a test. It's a trial. It's a first step. And so it's kind of a low-stakes, low-attendance way of dealing with this, so they can slowly ramp up to what's going to be a much, much bigger opening once one of the theme parks come back.
Now, this trial run is happening in Florida, not California. And you believe that out of all the Disney parks, the ones in California will probably reopen last. Why last? Why us, Robert?
Well, because, A, there are so many of us. And secondly, because Disneyland is their oldest and in many ways smallest, tightest park. There's a lot more space out in Florida for people to practice social distancing out in their Magic Kingdom park. At Disneyland, you know, anyone who's been there knows 6 feet between people, that's like, you know, you've got three or four other parties within 6 feet of you most times at Disneyland. So it's going to be really tight. They're going to need to get a lot of experience with some other parks before I think they're going to be able to do anything here. And then with all of those annual pass holders that are going to want to come back to the park, it's going to be really tough for them to come up with a system that keeps everybody happy and not frustrated and keeps them all safe.
Talking to Robert Niles, founder and editor of the site Theme Park Insider. Now, even before this pandemic, places like Disneyland were already struggling to try and limit huge crowds. They tried to manage that in the past, make it more expensive to go. That really didn't work. What might they try now?
Well, they came on with something really kind of interesting last year with that new Flex annual pass that they developed, which was an annual pass where you had to make an advance reservation to use it. You just couldn't show up at the park and stroll in. You had to go online through their app and choose the day that you wanted to visit. And I think that's going to become the industry standard now as theme parks look to reopening. Six Flags has already announced that they'll be doing that at all of their theme parks, including Magic Mountain, for the remainder of 2020, that you'll have to come online and make an advance reservation to show up because they're trying to limit capacity. If you can only have about 25% of the normal crowd in the park, it's a lot easier to keep people spaced. But they don't want people to come up and be disappointed that the crowd, that the park is filled for the day. So that's all they'll be going to advance reservations. Most likely for Disney, they haven't announced it officially yet. They've said they're looking at it, but Six Flags has definitely decided to go in that direction.
Because we've been focused on Disney here, but are they really the ones to watch when it comes to policies? Will other parks just follow suit? Because, Robert, I got a Universal pass that's burning a hole in my pocket. I want to use it.
Universal in Orlando has opened up their
that doesn't help me, Robert.
Area as well. They actually opened last week. And a lot of the same procedures that you've got at Disney, you've got to have, everyone's got to have a mask, you do the temperature check, there's still all the social distancing. So, I mean, they're learning a lot of what works there and doesn't work that eventually I think they'll implement here at City Walk, which most likely will open before the park as soon as California gives the okay in Los Angeles County for, in-person dining and retail to open up more than they have already.
Actually, we're getting word from one of the LA County supervisors, Catherine Barger, that they're setting a goal to reopen LA County by July 4th. So we'll see if they can hold to that. And maybe that's when all the theme parks will finally start to open, like Universal and City Walk. Now, you know, when the parks do reopen, would there be enough visitors going to make it worthwhile for them to open up?
That is literally the billion-dollar question for the theme park industry right now. I think there's a great deal of concern among parks as to, you know, if we open up, will people show up? I mean, there'll be some diehard fans that'll be there. Horrible pun. I'm sorry about that one. But there'll be some people who really want to be there on the first day. But a lot of people are just going to say, you know what? This virus is still out there. It's still contagious. You know, I want to see how things go before I feel comfortable going to a place like Disneyland or Universal instead. So, I mean, naturally, that might help keep the attraction, keep the crowd levels down. But there's a lot of concern that if we don't get to something like a vaccine or we don't get to treatments quickly, that this could have a real drag effect on the theme park industry for some time.
Because, Robert, that's the thing, right? You got to convince customers that it's safe to go, to feel comfortable going. When it comes to movie theaters, restaurants, and sporting events, I don't, because I'm just going to be sitting there, not moving. But with theme parks, I'm going to be moving around. So I actually feel better about that than all of the others.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things about this is that, you know, some of the emerging research on this is that outside is safer than inside. Moving around is safer than being in close contact with somebody else. So for a lot of theme park attractions, say if you're going out to Six Flags Magic Mountain, you're outside all the time. You're on high-speed rides. It's not like you're standing face-to-face with someone in closed encounter for an extended period. You know, the risk there might be a lot lower than if you're something like a movie theater or a restaurant where you're sitting close with other people in a contained environment where you're sharing that air for hours. So, I mean, we'll see how the public feels, but ultimately, and the things that theme parks are really selling is that feeling of safety and security and comfort and joy. And if they can deliver that, then people will come back. But if people are still a little concerned and afraid, it's going to be tough.
Robert Niles, founder and editor of the site Theme Park Insider. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, if you missed any part of the show today, just head to wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us all over social media. We're at Take Two on Twitter. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.